The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now we're going to stay with American politics for another little while. The public calls from Democrats asking President Joe Biden to bow out of the presidential race have quieted in recent days, but private efforts to nudge the president and his top aides is continuing. This report from CNN.
Pressure is growing on President Biden from within his own Democratic Party to step aside in this race. Now, this afternoon, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries held a Zoom meeting with the ranking members of the committees to kind of get feel their temperature, take the temperature about their feelings about the 2024 election before Congress is set to return tomorrow. And sources tell CNN that in that private phone conversation, that the number of lawmakers who wanted to see the president step aside outweighed those who spoke up in support of him staying in this race. CNN has learned about six of those Democratic lawmakers have said that they believe it is time for the president to leave the 2024 race, that it included lawmakers like Congressman Takano, Congressman Nadler, also Congresswoman Wild of Pennsylvania, a key battleground state. Sources have also told CNN that lawmakers like Congresswoman Maxine Waters, as well as Congressman Bobby Scott, spoke up in support of the president staying in this race. Now, one of the concerns that was expressed in this phone call is the potential that keeping Biden at the top of the Democratic ticket could weigh down other Democrats running in competitive races in the House and Senate. There is a concern about Democrats being unable to win back the House majority if Biden remains at the top of the Democratic ticket. Now, these private calls from these lawmakers join the already other five Democratic lawmakers who, since the debate, have called for President Biden to step aside publicly.
Well, as you heard from Jennifer Ewing of Republicans Abroad, she expects Biden will not be the candidate and expects that Kamala Harris will have to be the candidate. Otherwise, the funds so far gathered by the Democrats might just not be available to a candidate. But there is no question that the political temperature in the United States has been heightened over the last while. Ambivalence is not the same as apathy. In fact, having mixed political views can often lead people to endorse taking extreme action, often violent action. To talk about political extremism in the United States and what can be done to tackle it is Dr. Richard Petty, Professor of Psychology at Ohio State University. Richard, good morning and welcome.
Good morning to you.
Now, talk to me about how people become radicalized to the point that they would favor a violent response to political issues.
Yeah, well, our research concerns people who are extreme in their attitudes. So we'll begin with those. It is the people who have the most extreme views on their side who are most likely to support or commit violence themselves. But we were interested in, among those who have this extreme view, who are they who are particularly vulnerable to support violence? And it turned out, when we did surveys across a whole bunch of topics, political topics, abortion, support for COVID policies, all sorts of different kinds of things, we found it was the people who had extreme views but were conflicted about those views, who were ambivalent about them, rather than those who were unconflicted about those extreme views who were most likely to support violence. So that's the beginning of the study.
It seems counterintuitive that someone who says on the one hand or on the other hand that those kind of people could end up condoning political violence compared to those who are gung-ho for a particular cause.
It is odd, and it was surprising. But in fact, it is that conflict about having something about which you should not be conflicted, right? If you have an extreme view, as you just said, you shouldn't really be conflicted, right? Your view's extreme. If you're conflicted and you see both sides, or at least part of the other side, why would you be conflicted? So sometimes the conflict that people feel, this ambivalence, doesn't have to come from just you seeing both sides. Sometimes you can feel conflicted about a position because you're strongly on one side, but your best friend is on the other side, or a parent, or some other person you care about. So you feel conflicted about a candidate or about COVID policies, again, not because you personally see both sides, but the conflict comes from disagreement with others that you care about.
So rowing with people that you care about political issues can raise the whole temperature of the debate.
It can. And in some cases, this support for violence is a way of saying, no, my side really is right. And I'll show you how right it is by being extreme. But if you felt totally comfortable, you were in a group who all supported your candidate, for example, you wouldn't have this need to go out and do something extra to prove yourself.
Now, the kind of information that people have, I mean, we know all about fake news and how mainstream media, who are generally credited with trying to fact check and so on, how they can find it very difficult to combat the powerful effect of social media.
Yes, indeed. Especially when the social media feeds you exactly what they know makes you angry. And so sometimes it isn't just stuff on your side, right? Because if you just got more stuff on your side, you would just go, oh, my side is right. Everything's fine. But they give you the worst case scenario about the other side. And so now I'm seeing both sides, and maybe some of it gets through and I think, you know, well, maybe the other side does have some merit, but I've been a lifelong person who's on this side. How can it be the other side is right? And that, again, gets you to feel like I need to do something to show just how right my side is.
Now, the question of whether you vote in a particular direction because you want to support what your candidate is advocating, or whether you vote in a particular way because you hate the other guy so much.
Yes, that's another factor. Hate, unfortunately, is much stronger than love in terms of motivating action. So we know that people who are voting because they want to stop the other side are stronger in their views. They can become more extreme and things like that. And one of the interesting things from some of the research we've done is it turns out that most people might have thought that it was the strongest partisans who hate the most, but it's really independents people who are not identified with a party. People who are identified with a party, maybe this seems intuitive to you, vote to support that party because they're identified with that party. Independents in the U.S. context are people who don't identify with either party. So in some sense, they already have an oppositional orientation, right? I don't like either party, which is why I'm independent. So the question for that person is, who do I dislike the most? That's the person I have to stop or vote against.
And presumably this is what is keeping the Biden campaign energized, insofar as you can use that word about Joe Biden at the moment. It keeps them energized because they believe that independents will despise Donald Trump more than they have reservations about Joe Biden.
Yes, independents are the key to the U.S. election. Both sides, Republicans and Democrats, need to convert independents. They already have their partisans. And because independents are motivated by hate, each side has to say the other side is terrible. So not only does Biden have to rely on saying how terrible Trump is, Trump has to rely on getting people to think how terrible another term of Biden would be. So the election just keeps devolving into this, you know, double haters, as it's called these days.
Now we could regard all of your research as kind of academic and very interesting for its own sake. And then you have real life intruding on academic research when you have Thomas Matthew Crooks actually firing at a presidential candidate in Donald Trump. What impact does that kind of real life evident political violence have on people's voting intentions?
Unfortunately, for some of the most extreme people, they will see that as reinforcing. They had said, you know, 20% of Americans these days say that sometimes political violence is necessary to support your cause. And so among that segment of the population, they might see it as something that's not terrible. Among most Americans, hopefully, the calls for unity on both sides might come to the fore, and maybe it will tend to reduce the temperature, because it's one thing to say you support violence. It's another thing to see it in action.
Now, the growth in support for political violence is quite extraordinary. I mean, a decade or two ago, there would not have been this huge cohort of the electorate who might support or resort to violence. How extreme has that acceleration been?
It's really remarkable that I've seen some surveys. You go back, it was in the single digits 20 years ago, people who said they support violence or violence was justified in some situations. As I mentioned, it's now up to about 20% of the election. And so that's why things when violence happened now, January 6th, or the attempted assassination of a presidential candidate, there's a pocket of people who see it in a more positive light, unlike in the 1960s when there was a similar kind of spate, even worse in some sense. Multiple candidates, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, all were subject to assassination. And the surveys at the time said people were horrified at that. That was just not the way things should be. Whereas today, although most Americans are horrified by it, to be sure, there is a growing segment who might feel that it is appropriate.
Now, in this jurisdiction, overnight, we had some on-street protests, which degenerated into riots, anti-immigration protests here because of the building of centers for asylum seekers, those who are seeking international protection and are entitled to under international law. But there's one slightly reassuring element to that is that we don't have guns on our streets. We don't have, people with an arsenal at home. And that's what's maybe more worrying about political violence in the United States is the access to firearms.
It is indeed. And every year, the number of people who get guns increases. So as one side sees violence on one side, there are more people who think, well, our side needs to be armed. It's just amazing how many more guns there are in the U.S.
Yeah, something like 400 million guns.
Yeah,
more than the population, more than one per man, woman, and child.
It is quite startling, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you think that this is a phase in American politics? As you mentioned, the 60s and the assassination of people like Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, the attack on George Wallace, attacks on Ronald Reagan, Gerald Ford, as well as the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and of course, prior to that, his brother John F. Do you believe this is a phase of American politics that will wane again? Is there any hope that there'll be some sort of rapprochement between the political sides?
We can certainly be hopeful, and Trump is a very unique political figure, and so a lot of violence, and this spike sort of took place in 2016. It was interesting last night at the Republican convention how a bunch of commentators think that Trump may have changed. You know, maybe one incident, and you know, it's not uncommon for people who came within an inch of their life to sort of rethink their rhetoric, and so we'll see. Trump even said he's changing his speech, that his speech was going to be full of anti-immigrant sentiment and all sorts of things that might provoke people to violence. And he said now he's going to give a more unifying message. So we'll see if that happens, how long it lasts. But if the politicians change and there's something fundamental that occurs in a change, then maybe there is potential hope.
Well, there's one man who has changed, and that's J.D. Vance, who's done a complete U-turn on Trump himself in recent years. So maybe political minds can be changed. Anyway, it's a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much, Dr. Richard Petty, Professor of Psychology at Ohio State University. Well, now, some more of your texts on Kulak. A lot of those immigrants are married men with families of their own, just trying to make a better life. There are many Palestinian men there. Nobody wants to leave their own country. Nobody wants to leave their own family and come here to an uncertain future. I do, however, feel anyone who commits crimes here should serve their sentence and then be immediately deported, never to be allowed to return. But let's give them a chance to be processed and please show some common decency. That's from Mel. Connor says, this country needs thousands of male workers, especially across a variety of industries, construction workers, drivers, etc. We now have thousands of males looking to enter this country. Speed up the asylum system. If these people have skills to help our country build houses, build roads, drive trucks, etc., then let them in and use the legal processes to so do. Again on Coolock, a gang has arrived to our estate and dealing has started. Coolock Gardaí will send a car when one becomes available, but they won't come. And the dealers will continue dealing until 9 o'clock this evening. And this location is near enough to Crown Paints. So perhaps you could borrow a few Gardaí from up the road and try to persuade them to deal with that problem.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.